Welcome to the Plastic Podcast. Today we're talking about some of our favorite films from the recent Toronto International Film Festival. This is Robert Davis. In the first part of September, J. Robert Parks and I were both in Toronto for the annual film festival. And we saw a bunch of movies, wrote about a lot of them on the web, and we'll write about more of them as they come out in theaters later over the next year. But we thought we'd spend one episode of the podcast talking about a few of our favorites. So that's what we're going to do today to wrap up our Toronto coverage. Here's J. Robert Parks.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
I think the last time we talked on the podcast, we did the late summer speed round, and we talked, I don't know, about 13, 14, 15 films, and some of them longer than others. But you and I were at the Toronto Film Festival earlier this month, and I had a great time, I think, or at least I did, as always.
Yep.
And so today we're going to talk about our Toronto experience and films we liked and things that we thought were interesting and maybe films we didn't like. How was the festival for you?
It was good. I think there was a little bit of negativity going into the festival that there were a lot of movies that played at Cannes that a lot of people there liked that didn't end up showing in Toronto, which was a disappointment to some people. And just general concerns, as always, about the general direction of the festival. But it turned out that I ended up seeing a lot of movies that I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And maybe compared to previous years, there weren't quite so many that I was just extremely impressed by, but there were lots of really strong movies. And I saw very few bad movies this year, too. So I think that it was overall a pretty strong year.
Yeah, I agree. Going in, I think I had the same feeling. It was like, I'm not quite sure there's many films that I'm really looking forward to as in past years. Particularly last year seemed to be just every other film was one I was really anticipating. And this year, there were some of those, but also a lot of films where I was taking some chances or trying something new and different. It was a strong festival for me too. Probably only one film that I would say was flat out awesome, but lots of really strong, excellent films, and like you, very few bad ones. It was a good festival.
What was the flat out awesome?
Claire Denis' 35 Shots of Rum, which I know you like as well. I saw that fairly early on in the festival. That became the standard to which the others were sort of tried to measure and couldn't quite reach those heights.
Yeah, Claire Denis is obviously one of my favorite filmmakers. She made a movie called Beau Travail and Friday Night, Trouble Every Day, and her most recent movie called The Intruder. Confused a lot of people, and even people who are fans, I think, found that movie a little difficult to warm up to. I think that's a really rich and complex movie, so I've enjoyed watching that repeatedly. But 35 Rums was, I think, an easier movie for a lot of people to warm up to. I don't think it's necessarily going to make her a lot of brand new fans because it's the same elliptical style of storytelling that she has where you really have to watch what people are doing and the glances, and every shot matters. You know, there is no casual, if it seems like nothing's happening, then you're on the wrong wavelength, I believe. It's a beautiful film. 35 Shots of Rum was one of my favorites too.
Now, I know that you saw that, like that was your first film of the festival, right?
It was, yeah.
Did you find that to be difficult? In other words, were you sort of comparing everything to that as the festival went on?
No, I think it re-energized my interest because, I started off actually very tired, which is not a good way to start a festival when you're going to watch 40 movies in 10 days or 9 days, whatever. And I did an unexpected interview very early on too. And so I felt like, gosh, am I getting off on a bad foot here? But then I saw Claire Denis' movie, and I'm always a little apprehensive about that even because I think, oh, I hope it's good because I want to like her movies. And then when it was good, I sort of felt like, oh, now I'm ready for the rest of the festival. I'm ready to talk to Claire Denis, actually. So I scheduled an interview with her, and then I thought, I'm also going to try to see the movie again later in the festival, which is something that I always like to do, is pick one movie to see twice. Uh-huh. And that was a movie I saw twice this time.
I think a festival experience is a really different one for people who haven't been, because there is this sort of sense of both anticipation as well as a bit of anxiety is not the word, but there's a sort of a edgy feeling am I gonna, these films that I'm really excited about, are they going to measure up to them, my hopes for them? And because it's such a intense environment where you're really And you're seeing 4 or 5 movies a day. And when you're not watching movies, you're talking about them with people. And there's a bit of pressure almost. I know that the first couple of days of the fest, I saw some good films, but some mediocre ones. And I was starting to think, am I judging fairly here? Am I just in the wrong frame of mind? And then on the third day, I saw this movie called Goodbye Solo, from the director who did Chop Shop, which I like that movie a great deal too.
Chop Shop and Man Push Cart.
That's right. I haven't seen Man Push Cart, but I like Chop Shop very much. And Goodbye Solo is equally good, I think. And so once I saw that, then it almost felt like, you know, I broke the ice and now I can really sort of settle in and enjoy the rest of the festival.
Yeah, I missed Goodbye Solo, but now I'm looking forward to it. My experience of a festival is that I always come out of the festival with another list.
Yes.
You know, you go into the festival with a list of things you want to see, and you come out of the festival with a list of things you didn't know you were supposed to see, but when people were talking about them, you think, oh man, I've got to see Goodbye Solo.
Yep.
Whenever it comes to a festival near me, or it happens to get distribution or however, maybe on DVD one day.
Yeah. And that, I think, is one of the fun things about Toronto is or any festival, but particularly Toronto, because so many people that I know and respect go to Toronto. And as you've talked before, anyone who tries to say, wow, it was a great year at Toronto, well, I mean, you saw, you know, 1/5 of the movies, you know, so it's hard to sort of judge that way.
Everybody has their own sort of view of the festival.
Sure. Right? But yet it's fun then to compare lists. And for me, that's a really enjoyable part, is to, when I get home, to start looking at other people's blogs, to sort of, you know, run through conversations in my mind and mentally make lists of movies that I'm looking forward to.
Speaking of lists, one way that I know that this was a successful festival for me is that when I look at my, let's see, I have like 5 very favorite films. They're radically different from each other. There are a couple of French films. There's 35 Shots of Rum, which we've already mentioned, A Christmas Tale by Arnaud Desplechin. So 2 French films. In fact, I saw a lot of really good French films at this festival. But then there's also Rachel Getting Married, American film by Jonathan Demme, the guy who directed Silence of the Lambs.
Which has some big stars in it.
Yeah, I mean, Anne Hathaway. And so it's, you know, it's going to be at a theater near you. And then an experimental film called RR by James Binning, which is nothing but 2 hours of trains going by. Could not be more different from Rachel Getting Married. And then Wendy and Lucy, which is a small American film by Kelly Reichardt, who made Old Joy, which was one of my favorites from a couple of years ago.
Yep.
So these are really different movies.
Now, why did you like Rachel Getting Married?
Well, Rachel Getting Married wasn't actually on my plan to see, but for some reason, my schedule was in disarray in the first couple of days. I'll spare you the details, but I ended up ducking into several movies that I hadn't originally planned, and in a couple of cases, they were bad choices. In one case, it worked out really well, and it was Rachel Getting Married. This is a movie that has distribution and is going to be coming out soon, so that's the sort of thing I wouldn't normally program at the festival, because I know I'll have a chance to see it later. But it's about a woman named Kim, who returns to her family's big gathering for her sister's wedding. Her sister is Rachel, who's getting married, and so it's sort of a family reunion movie. Mm. But Kim is the black sheep of the family and has had all kinds of problems and caused all kinds of problems in the family. And so it reminds me a little bit of the Noah Baumbach film, Margot at the Wedding, with Nicole Kidman.
Yep.
Except that this is full of heart and soul. Mm. And I can't say that about, you know, I was actually one of the few people who I think appreciated Margot at the Wedding more than some folks, but it's not in the same league as Rachel Getting Married. Mm. One of the things I loved about it is that it's shot in this really naturalistic, almost documentary style, where the situation is allowed to play out for a very long time, and the camera just sort of huddles in the corner and watches this. For example, the rehearsal dinner goes on for, I don't know how long, at least half an hour, maybe 45 minutes of the movie, but it's so rich. You get to see all the speeches from the various family members, and some are better than others, and some are funny, and some are, you know, you're cringing, and it just feels very real, and it's very emotional, and I was very impressed with Anne Hathaway's performance. I think I've only seen her in Get Smart, opposite Steve Carell, but she was just amazing in this movie as this sort of fierce but quivering character.
Mm. One of the themes that you and I both noticed, and other people too, is that we seem to be seeing a lot of family reunion movies.
Yeah.
The Claire Denis film is sort of in that yeah. vein, and the Des Plaisance is sort of in that vein. I know one of the films that I really liked was a Japanese film called Still Walking. Mm. And it's also this movie about a family coming together. In this case, it's sort of their annual memorial service for a brother who died too young, and so it's these two siblings and their spouses and children, and then the patriarch and matriarch of the family, and it has some references to Ozu, but it really is just a beautiful portrait's not the right word. It's just a day in this family, and both the way in which they love each other, but also the way in which they get on each other's nerves. And the father doesn't really like having a lot of people around. Not that he's a bad guy, but he's a little bit grumpy. But I love that film because it, even though it's a Japanese film, it feels so much like my family in a lot of ways. And I think that was true for a lot of people who saw that film. Did you see that one?
I did, yeah. And I felt the same way. And we saw this sort of family reunion recur so many times over the couple of weeks that we were there that you'd think that it would be tiring after a while. But I enjoyed each one. I mean, there were those two, mm-hmm. Summer Hours. Mm-hmm. There were a number of them, but every family is unique, mm-hmm. and yet every family is the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't matter if it's from France or it's from the US or it's from Japan, I recognized myself and my family yeah. in all of these too.
Yeah. And particularly, well, I think with all of the ones that I saw, there's that both laughter and sadness as you're watching it, because you recognize your yeah. own family in that. And so you laugh at the foibles and there are these, not exactly sentimental moments, but there are these moments of community and those resonated with me. But then there's some, there's a sadness because with all of these films, part of it is that when you have multiple generations, of course, the oldest generation is getting old. And so there's sadness with that of what's being lost and of time passing. And so I found those themes particularly rich across the festival this year.
There's almost always someone missing.
Mm-hmm.
Families are never full intact trees.
That's right.
They're always pruned at various points.
And, yeah, that's a good point.
And those people are always sort of present but absent at the same time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was in all these movies.
Yeah, that's right. You mentioned Summer Hours by Olivia Assayas.
Yeah.
What was that about?
It was a family reunion. It was about a matriarch and her three grown kids in France, and also her love of her uncle, who was a painter, and he's dead, but she likes to preserve his memory and his work, and so she's exhibiting his paintings and putting together monographs of his work, and so they're all looking at that. And it's very much about this sort of idea that objects live on, furniture and paintings that were always hanging on the wall. They live on after people die.
Mm.
And so when the woman in the family, the matriarch, dies fairly early in the film, now her children are left to sort of deal with her house and her things. And they sometimes feel differently about those objects than she did, and yet they want to preserve her memory of those things as well. And so it's a really interesting way to look at how objects are sort of a part of our lives as well.
It's funny you say that because I was home this summer, and my grandparents have lived in the same house for 55 years, and so as long as I've been alive, and I hadn't been in the basement in quite a while, and I went downstairs to the basement this year because I was trying to find something, and all these objects that I hadn't looked at in 10 years, but were very important in my childhood, were suddenly there. And so just the memories that they brought about or brought back, it's funny how that works. That sounds good. I'll look forward to that one. Another one to put on the list.
Yeah. There was this recurring image in all of these movies of the box that comes out from under the mm-hmm. bed that has all these photos mm-hmm. and old letters in it. I can't count, it must have happened a dozen times yeah. in a dozen different movies, and every time I kind of smiled.
Yeah, I saw that in a movie, a Bosnian film called Snow. a very lovely little nice film. I know it's playing here in the Chicago Film Festival for people who are in Chicago, but probably coming to other festivals. It's a movie that takes place just after the war between Bosnia and Serbia. And so this village of mostly women, the men have either died in the war or been killed, murdered. And so the women are sort of trying to get things back together. But at one point, the main character pulls out this music box full of photos. And while the music sort of very faintly plays in the background, you sort of look at these photos as she looks at them. And it's a very, very powerful moment in the film and of what is a very nice movie.
Snow,
that's right. I also saw a movie called Rain. I didn't see a movie called Sunshine this year, but I saw Snow and Rain. Rain is a film from the Bahamas, which I think is the first movie that I've ever seen from the Bahamas. Mm. And it was nice. It's a first film, and it feels like a first film. It's got some cool things about it, but it's a bit clumsy at times. It's about this teenage girl who... she lives with her grandmother, but at the beginning of the film, the grandmother dies. And so the girl has to go live with her mother, who has some problems. And so the best parts of the film are the relationship between the girl and her mom. And those are really quite nice. The rest of the film doesn't completely work, but I don't know. Small movies from small countries I have a lot more grace for. And so I enjoyed it despite its flaws.
So 35 Shots of Rum and Goodbye Solo were two of your favorites. Mm-hmm. What were some of your other very, very favorites?
I saw three Wavelengths programs this year. Wavelengths is sort of devoted to experimental and avant-garde cinema. And in the past, I've always tried to see at least one, just because I find it almost a palate cleanser kind of in the midst of all these narrative films. But this year, there were three different programs I was interested in seeing. And my favorite were these two films by Nathaniel Dorsky called Winter and Saraband. I'm not terribly qualified to talk about, you know, experimental cinema. And so I'll make a fool of myself if I go on too long about these movies. But I really enjoyed these two relatively short experimental films. I think they were really beautiful. You saw those too.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Nathaniel Dorsky a lot. He's from San Francisco, mm-hmm. where I obviously used to live. And so whenever I see his films, I always think of San Francisco. Mm. The first one, Winter, that you mentioned, he mentioned this after the screening too, that it does feel like winter in San Francisco, mm. where there is no snow and there are no people bundled up, but it has this sort of crisp gray feeling that I always feel in San Francisco. But yeah, his movies are silent for one thing. So you're sitting mm-hmm. there in total silence with an audience.
Yep.
No music. It's the complete silence. And then they're just shots of a few seconds. They vary, but you know, maybe 10 seconds long, and followed by another shot. And each one is sort of static, and yet things are moving in the shot. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe shadows or colors or its feet going by. Mm-hmm. And it's always kind of fun to try to figure out what's he pointing his camera at. Mm-hmm. But really, I think the way he'd rather you see his movies is as colors mm-hmm. and shapes mm-hmm. and movement and mm-hmm. and relationships between these shots.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in one shot, you know, things are sort of moving left and they're blue, and the next shot they're moving right and they're blue, and they're pointed at totally different things that he's found in San Francisco as he's walking around. But he's not trying to construct a view of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. He's trying to capture something else and create something of its own that's beautiful.
No, about halfway through the first film, Winter, I was feeling a bit frustrated because I was trying to figure out what I was looking at. And
it's not always easy.
No, it's very difficult because Dorsky is often shooting through things, and often it's out of focus, and you can't quite figure out what it is. And what I realized about halfway through Winter is that I needed to stop trying to figure out what I was looking at and just enjoy the color and enjoy the light and enjoy the form. And Dorsky was almost trying to get me to untrain my eye. Mm-hmm. Because in life, of course, the eye is looking for specific form and consistency and patterns. You know, what am I looking at? And one of the things I loved about Dorsky's films is that they train my eye to look in different ways and to see things not as sort of form and pattern as much, but as color and light. And so that I found really beautiful once I made that transition.
as a resident of San Francisco, I would leave his movies and walk around and think, boy, how come I never see that? How does he find those such beautiful little spots on the corner, you know, or on the sidewalk or reflected in a window? Yeah. And every once in a while, as I'm walking down, you know, the same block that he must be on sometimes, I'll think, there in that corner is a Dorsky shot right there.
Yeah. So
what were the other experimental programs you saw?
Well, I also saw RR, or Railroad, by James Binning, which I didn't like quite as much. There's lots of reasons why that might be true. I mean, one of the biggest might be is I was a bit tired. It's because, like you say, it's 2 hours or almost 2 hours of just shots of trains. And obviously it's a lot more complicated and varied than that. And I enjoyed it for a while, but I did find myself... my eyes glazing over a bit. Just found myself getting a little bit bored. And so I could appreciate that, even if I can't say that I enjoyed it as much as I maybe would have liked to. What did you like about it?
Well, I like how a lot of experimental film almost feels like a blank slate, and you can sort of project your own ideas onto it. But some filmmakers are just really good at planting seeds of those ideas and then giving you lots of space for your mind to wander in. And so as I'm sitting there watching, you know, just train after train after train in these still shots where the camera isn't moving, you start looking for, well, what's different about this from all the others? Well, the train's coming a different direction this time, or it's going a different way. Or, oh, now look at this, it's curving. We haven't seen a train that curves before. You know, you start noticing all these little things. And then you start listening. You hear the sounds of trains. You hear the sound of the wind. And you listen for the train to fade as it's disappearing into that dot in the horizon. You know, you think, at what point do I no longer hear the train and I only hear the wind, or I only hear the, you know, the rustling of the grass? Sometimes he has sound playing from a car radio or something near the camera or near wherever he's recorded this, you know, and it's playing some old radio show. And so then you start thinking, oh, old radio shows, this is like old Americana. You know, we used to ship things by train all the time. And so then you're thinking about America and thinking about the importance of trains. And, you know, is the movie about those things? I don't know what it's about, but those are the sorts of things that come into your mind when you're watching. And I love that. And I also... counted. I don't know why I did this, but I started counting the number of shots and the number of trains.
And how many were there?
There were 43 shots of 45 moving trains, one stationary train, and one truck rigged to run on the rails, by my count.
For me, I made a lot of those connections as well, and enjoyed letting my mind wander through those until about maybe the 80, 85 minute mark. And then for some reason, I stopped thinking of interesting things, and then that starts just to become a bit tedious.
It's hard to know how long you'd want something like that to go on. Like if it were 8 hours, would I still have had things to think about? I don't know. Eight hours of trains going by, there's still something artistic about that too, but I'm not sure I'd want to sit there for all 8 hours. Who knows? Yeah. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Not many people will have a chance or even maybe want to see James Binning's film. But you actually saw several movies that are coming out in theaters relatively soon. What were some of your favorites of those?
That's true. Well, there was Rachel Getting Married, which I mentioned, but also this movie called The Wrestler, which is by Darren Aronofsky, the guy who made Requiem for a Dream and more recently The Fountain. And he's a guy he's an American filmmaker who has a really strong reputation based on a very small number of movies. And I've always been a little bit mystified by that. Not that he's a bad filmmaker at all, but some people are really crazy about this great, you know, Darren Aronofsky. I'm always a little skeptical, I have to say. But I heard, you know, the Venice Film Festival happens just before Toronto and actually overlaps with the festival a lot. So partway through Toronto, we always hear buzz from Venice. And in fact, Darren Aronofsky's film won the big prize at Venice. And so that was a big surprise, because in previous years, things like Still Life by Jia Zhangke, you know, this very austere movie from China, won. And so it's very unusual that Darren Aronofsky film starring Mickey Rourke and Marissa Tomei won. And so I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to try to see this. I know I'll have a chance to see it later, but I'm going to go into a screening. And I was really surprised. It's a great movie. Mickey Rourke plays a pro wrestler. You know, the kinds you see on Saturday afternoon TV or something, the guys throwing each other around and doing all these theatrics and wearing capes and masks and stuff, that sort of wrestling. But he's 20 years past his prime. And even when he was in his prime, he was, you know, he was king of a trashy world. And it's about his life now and about how he can't quite pay the rent on his trailer, but he's still makes appearances and, you know, signs autographs for whoever wants to come and see them and get them. And it's kind of a dark and dingy view of his world and his sort of attempt to rise above that and still be worth something and get in touch with his daughter and have a relationship with Marissa Tomei, who is a stripper who is about his same age and who her life parallels his in a lot of ways because they both use their bodies for and can't forever, you know? Right. There's a time limit on this sort of thing. So it's a sad, sad movie. And as someone who hasn't been following Mickey Rourke's career or the tabloids about him, I was really shocked to see what he looks like. I expected someone who looks like the guy I saw in Angel Heart, a decade, 15 years ago, whenever that was. He looks really different. He looks like a pro wrestler now. Mm. He looks like someone who's done a lot to his body. And so he's perfectly cast in this role, I think, because that's what the movie's about. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely one to look for.
Oh, cool.
There's another one that's really popular at festivals right now called Slumdog Millionaire by Danny Boyle. He's the guy who directed Trainspotting and another bunch of other movies since then. Takes place entirely in India, mostly in Mumbai. And it's about a kid, I believe you saw this film too.
I did.
It's about a kid who ends up winning the Indian version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And it instantly comes under investigation because how could this guy who grew up on the streets and has no education possibly know the answers to all these questions? So the movie is a flashback, basically, of how he learned the answer to each one of these questions through some trial on the streets. And so it's sort of a biography, a chronicle of his 20 years of life on the streets with the frame of a game show.
Yeah,
it's a fun, crowd-pleasing movie, but it's also, I think, fairly silly. But it's so musical. Mm-hmm. There is lots of Indian pop music and very percussive beat throughout that I can see why a lot of people really like it.
Yeah, I don't like it quite as much. I understand the appeal and the music is great. And I, you know, my toe tapped on beat as I was supposed to. But it's the movie is so schematic because, you know, it's going to show how he knew the answers to all these questions. And if you know anything about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or... Is that the name of the show?
Yeah.
It's like, I can't remember what that show is.
Which looks, by the way, exactly the way the American version
looks. Yes, yes. They're all the same. Just replicated across the globe. But Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? I mean, if you know anything about the game, I knew 45 minutes before the end of the movie exactly how this movie was going to end. Exactly how it was going to end. And to me, that's never a good sign. And so I found that frustrating. And it has this very... superficial view of India, a very Western idea of India where it just is going to sort of check off all the things that we know about India, you know, Taj Mahal, bing, you know, Indian call centers with people calling people in America, ding, you know, young girls trapped in brothels, ding, you know, it just feels like it's giving us, I don't know. It's the sort of movie that it gets on my nerves. I'll be honest, I enjoyed it while I was watching it. But then the next day when I was thinking about it, I found myself getting more and more pissed off. I mean, and the movie's not bad. Although Danny Boyle, he just doesn't know when to let it alone. You know, he's got this hyperkinetic editing style and he's just throwing brilliant color after brilliant color at you. And it's all super stylized. And yeah, I mean, it's going to make a ton of money, but I found it really frustrating.
I mentioned to you afterward that I felt like the girl in the movie, who's his the girl he loves for years and years and years and must pursue, that she's like a flag that needs to be captured instead of a character, you know? I felt like the movie evaporated as soon as I left the theater.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. Any other movies coming out that you like?
Well, I'm not sure how widely this is going to play, but people know Steven Soderbergh, the guy who directs, you know, Ocean's 11 and 12 and 13 and all of those. Well, when he's not making those movies, between those, he makes these smaller movies on digital video, smaller in some sense. But his latest one is called Che, about Che Guevara, and is a 4.5-hour epic about first his adventures in Cuba and then his failure to do the same thing in Bolivia. Did you see Che?
I did. Yeah, I saw it towards the end of the festival. I saw it all in a 4-hour chunk. I know that some of the screenings people were seeing it half and half, but I was, you know, it was 4.5 hours with intermission.
Because it really can work as two movies. It may even be released that way.
I think that's right. Yeah, that's what I had heard, is that it'll be released as two different parts. I think the first part is more successful. It's more maybe straightforward in that it's, you know, the Cuban Revolution. And so Benicio del Toro plays Che Guevara. And so we've got Fidel Castro there, and they're basically making their way through the jungles of Cuba and through across the hills until they finally reach Havana. And but I found that interesting, you know, because it's intercut with a speech that Guevara gave at the UN a few years later. And so we kind of cut from, you know, them trying to organize the various peasants in the jungle to sort of afterwards the speech. And I thought that was pretty interesting. The second half in Bolivia doesn't work quite as well for me. I know what Soderbergh's trying to do. He has a very, I think, clever and even beautiful rhyme scheme where what happens in Bolivia is very much parallel to what happened in Cuba, but it doesn't work. And Soderbergh wants to sort of examine the reasons why using this framing device or rhyme scheme, sorry. And so, once I figured out what was going on, I found myself getting a bit bored in the second part. It's not as interesting from just pure narrative, and it feels a bit more didactic almost. And so it didn't work quite as well for me. How about you?
Yeah, both movies are deliberately undramatic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm surprised actually that they're going to be in theaters at all.
Yeah, I am too.
It's not a crowd pleaser or anything like that. It's not exciting, even though it sort of sounds like, you know, fighting in the jungle could be presented that way. I'm not saying it should be, but I'm just describing what the movie's like. I sort of liked the elegance of the structure of here's the fall and here's the decline, or mm-hmm. here's the success and here's the failure. But I think that structure automatically isn't critical of the first half mm-hmm. because it needs the first half to be the success so that we can then have the failure compared to it
yeah.
as if everything that happened the first time was ideal. And right. now we're just sort of comparing ourselves to that, when maybe there are things about the first half that we know what Cuba is like now. And mm-hmm. I don't think that we would consider that it led to an ideal, and maybe there are reasons for that. Mm-hmm. The movie doesn't examine that. But I did like one thing that he did, and I may not have noticed this if they hadn't made this announcement before my screening. I saw them back to back also, and they told us there would be an intermission, but also that we would see a test on the screen during that intermission because they needed to change formats. And I thought, well, that's weird. Change mm-hmm. formats, you know, just for the, you know, apparently this, and it's obvious, the second half, it does not have the same widescreen ratio as the first half.
Yeah.
Which fits with the theme. Mm-hmm. You know, the first one is this sort of wide open, glorious look at the world. Mm-hmm. The second one is this very narrow, confined, constrained, failing
yep.
Attempt in Bolivia. And I liked that. And I wished he would have done sort of more mm-hmm. formally interesting things like that. But mm-hmm. there isn't really anything. And so I didn't take away much from this movie at all.
It's interesting. The movie opens with sort of a almost an overture. And I actually kind of liked that. It's almost a faux overture. And I was hoping there would be more sort of formal, playful things throughout the film. But with the exception of having sort of different aspect ratios and different types of cameras that he's using, so you get a different grain or a different look to the different scenes, there's not a lot that really happens in the film, you know, that I think would have made it, at least for me, a little more interesting.
I felt the same way about Traffic.
Mm.
I like Soderbergh's idea about trying to make more personal films when he's not making blockbusters. I just wish I liked them more, you know. I like his smaller, less ambitious, seemingly less ambitious movies like Bubble or yeah. The Limey is really my favorite.
Mm.
But Traffic also did some things where, you know, he had these four different stories that he shot different ways, and yet I didn't draw a lot from that, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
I wish he'd do a little bit more along those lines.
Yeah. So I always feel bad about talking about the movies I didn't like, because one of the things that I'm reminded of at Toronto is almost every film has its advocates. You know, almost every film that I could see, someone liked, and someone I respected liked. You know, so I saw this Polish movie called Four Nights with Anna that I just thought was a waste of time. And then I bump into people who liked it quite a bit, and people I respect. So to say that I don't like a film feels a bit false to me, because who knows why I didn't like it. I can give my reasons, but there are people out there who liked it. Like there's this Argentinian film called Salamandra, which I just hated. I hated it. It's about this mom who gets out of jail and she's kind of a damaged soul, and so, but she comes back to get her boy, who's maybe, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years old, and she's going to take him to the craziest hippie commune you've ever seen in your life. And the movie is just about what happens at this commune, and how the mother is not really being a good mother, and the sort of the danger that the boy is in, and I just really loathed it. It felt really provocative. It felt like the director is just trying to be transgressive and sort of poke a finger in the audience's eye, and it felt like sort of lightweight Hanukkah to me. And you know, Hanukkah only works if you really have the rigor to pull it off, and I just didn't feel like this film did. And yet then afterwards, you know, I'm bumping into people who loved it and people who really liked it. And so you start thinking, well, was I just in a bad mood? Was I tired? No, I don't think so. I don't like it. But that doesn't mean it's an awful film. I mean, it just means I didn't like it.
Yeah, my friends fall on both sides of that, and I really wish I would have seen it. Not that I can break the tie, but it just makes me very curious.
Yeah, yeah. And so, but no, I didn't see that many bad films. Nuri Bilge Ceylan, the Turkish filmmaker who did Distant, had a new film called Three Monkeys. And I didn't much care for that either. The cinematography is gorgeous. I mean, some of his shots are rivaling Tarkovsky's, which is what he's trying to do. But the story is dumb. You know, it's about this family and this this father who sort of takes the fall for a politician and goes to jail. And then gets out, and his wife has had an affair while he's been gone, and oh, holy crap, it's just dumb. And so that was frustrating. But no, I didn't see that many bad films, and you know, I can get worked up about the bad ones I saw, but how about you? You see anything you just didn't like?
I saw a couple of movies that, as I mentioned, my schedule was in disarray, and so I ended up picking a couple of movies that just happened to be at the right time and going into them cold. And I like to do that because often it's fun to discover something you knew nothing about. And
absolutely.
Even no one, there was no buzz because nobody had seen it yet, you know, and sometimes...
Yeah, you can be the first.
Sometimes those get forgotten because nobody's seen them, you know, or they never get discovered. But it didn't work this time. I saw a movie called Cold Lunch, which was very Magnolia-esque, but very, very ridiculous. Mm. And a movie called Patrick, age 1.5, which I probably should have walked out of, but I always feel bad about doing
that.
Yeah,
I do too. Yeah. Oh, one last film, real quick, just because this is sort of my chance to be contrarian, but Samira Mikhailbaf, an Iranian filmmaker, a daughter of Mohsen Mikhailbaf, has a new movie out called Two-Legged Horse, which most people at Toronto, at least that I heard of, hated, because it's a story about, it takes place in Afghanistan, and a boy is hired by a rich man to carry another crippled boy around. And a lot of people just hated the sort of the dehumanizing way in which the story plays out. But I want to mention that I think I found it really provocative because I see it as an allegory, very much in the manner of a Kafka short story, and particularly Kafka's The Metamorphosis, you know, in which sort of a person is turned into an animal.
Gregor Samsa.
Yes. In this case, the boy doesn't wake up as a horse, but he turns into a horse as the movie goes along. And so if you see it as some sort of neo-realist movie, then yeah, it's repulsive and it's disgusting. But I think if you see it as an allegory, particularly an allegory of how the rich treat the poor in our world and how the rich exploit the poor, then I think it's incredibly powerful. And so I just sort of wanted to, I know I'm in the minority on that movie, but I think that film deserves much better than it's received just because I don't think people are reading it properly. So... anyway.
Yeah, that's another one I missed.
Yeah, and again, I'm not sure that you or lots of people will like it, but I think it's a very powerful, intentionally provocative film. And I just, the whole way through, I just kept thinking, wow, this is a really interesting and useful allegory of what's going on in our world. And I'm glad she's doing it, even if people don't necessarily enjoy it.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. You can find us on the web at dailyplastic.com, where you'll find other episodes in this series of podcasts, along with a bunch of other stuff that we're doing. Feel free to leave us a comment to let us know what you think of this episode or other episodes. For example, if you think that I talk too fast sometimes on the podcast. If you prefer to leave an audio comment, call 415-287-4020. Speak slowly so that we can understand you. We'd love to hear from you. I'll be back next time to try to convince J. Robert Parks to see three great classic movies that he hasn't seen, and vice versa. That's on the next episode of the Plastic Podcast. We'll see you then. Bye.